The next case for argument is Farr against St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers. Ms. Runnels.
Yes, my name is Mary Runnels. I'm here on behalf of appellant David Farr to discuss gender discrimination and fair dealing. Mr. Berry will address defamation.
The two of you are just representing one litigant, are you not?
Correct.
We'd like to hear just from one lawyer for one litigant.
They just want to hear from one of us, so I'm up. Is that correct?
You're up.
Okay. With respect to gender discrimination, these cases, by their nature, are very much fact-driven. And the operative fact in this case is that in the pulmonary rehabilitation unit at St. Francis Hospital, because of their practices of computer usages, the passwords, the individual passwords, meant absolutely nothing. It was impossible to know who did what under any particular password. So on the day...
What difference does any of this make? Your client concedes that it was his web searches that led to this information being on the computer.
But he was doing nothing different from anybody else. He was using the computer for personal use during downtime, which was allowed to all of the...
You're not responding to my question. My question is, what difference did it make that somebody else could have done this when your client concedes that it was him who did it, in fact?
No, he does not concede that he did it. He did.
Yes, he did.
He admitted he visited the site, didn't he?
Yes, but the sites, there was... The sites were, there was nothing wrong with the sites. All the ill...
Yeah, that's
ill
different from saying somebody else might have done it. As this case comes to us, your client has conceded that this information was on the computer because of what he did. And you may or may not get anywhere from arguing that the employer shouldn't have sacked him on account of it, but arguing that it could have been somebody else just is not compatible with his concession.
Well, respectfully, I disagree, because had this assumption not been made at the beginning when it could not have been made, then the investigation could well have followed a very different route, which would have exonerated Mr. Farr. I say that because these offensive bookmarks that started the whole thing were put there as the result of malware that had nothing, no ill intent, no problem with what Mr. Farr was doing. Had they, his supervisors immediately assumed that he was responsible because he was the only male in the whole department when any of them could have done it. As a result, when they passed the hard drive to the IT department to look at, they did not disclose that the passwords were meaningless. They did not disclose that the supervisor had deleted the bookmarks, nor did they disclose that he had disclaimed any knowledge at all of what was there, which was only described to him in vague terms so that he could not answer to the charges. So, in the investigation, they knew what the result of the investigation was going to be. They knew the bookmarks were there. They knew they were under his passwords. They knew it was going to come back and say, this guy is bad. When, in fact, had they disclosed that information, perhaps the technicians would have looked at the firewalls before they were erased and seen what happened. Or perhaps they would not have accused him of ill intent because he erased
sounds,
the passwords when he didn't.
Like an argument one would make to a labor arbitrator in some kind of just cause proceeding. But we've said quite a lot of times that that has nothing to do with Title VII.
I understand that, but what we are saying is that from the moment those bookmarks were discovered, the entire investigation and decision-making process was a lie, was a pretext.
Now you're back to this fact that they focused on your client who actually did it, right? The employer focused on the person who was responsible. That doesn't sound like a violation of federal law.
All he was responsible for was going to a website that resulted in malware penetrating the system.
Counsel, trying to talk over me won't do you any good. That's the labor arbitrator point. You need to show that there is sex discrimination in the discharge decision. And it won't do just to say, well, they assumed the man was responsible because it was his password and porn, because he was responsible, right? He concedes that. Now, how does one show sex discrimination in this setup?
Because he did nothing, as far as the record shows, he did nothing different from his coworkers who were similarly situated from him. They were not disciplined in any respect for sharing the passwords.
Did they visit hacking and cracking sites?
We have no way to know that. The hard drive was erased.
But what does that have to do with gender discrimination? I just don't understand that.
The gender discrimination began at the instant that they determined that there was only one person they needed to ask about the material on the computer. They asked only one person when he was one of seven that could have been responsible. Everything that happened after that flowed from that decision. Everything. He was not told what he was accused of. He was not able to explain that these were not, in fact, hacking websites, that he had never intended to hack, that he had never downloaded anything. In fact, their computer records show that he had never downloaded anything, but they nonetheless accused him of doing that. And this all flows from that initial determination that he was the only one that could have done this, and it skewed the entire process from there to his dismissal and through the grievance committee. His coworkers did nothing different than he did. They visited websites on personal business. They shared passwords. And yet he is the only one that has suffered this fate. And as I say, we can't know whether they went to any place bad because it's been erased. Again, that's a way he's been treated differently. Only his information was saved, thus making it impossible to proceed. Not only that, the supervisors actively suppressed this information. They did not tell Alverno, they did not tell the grievance committee, they did not tell anybody that the passwords had been shared and that that they had erased it despite the information, and this had a tremendous effect on how it came out. She sent a false report to the grievance committee, she sent a false report to the Human Relations Department with that regard. And to understand the pretextual nature of this case, you really have to have the timeline firmly in mind, which we set out in our briefs, and you can follow. As I say, everything flowed from that instantaneous decision that he was the only one to be interviewed and to be investigated.
I'm still completely baffled. It sounds like the observation that you always find something in the last place, you look for it. It's because you found it there, so you stopped looking. He was the first person they asked, but he was also the person responsible, so there's no need to look further. If he'd been the third person they asked, he would still have been the person actually responsible, and then they would have stopped. So I don't understand. I just don't understand the theory here.
The theory is, I mean, he was responsible only in the respect that the website he looked at contained malware.
Right, that's what got him fired. He visited hacking sites. He says they downloaded porn behind his back.
Right.
And somebody who did those things on an office computer gets fired. Had he been the third person they interviewed, or the fifth, or the seventh, everything still would have happened just as it did, because he is, in fact, the one who's responsible. He's conceded it.
No, I just disagree. Had all the... Maybe nothing would have come from initially talking to everybody. That's entirely possible. They all might have said, I don't know.
Why? Had they talked to the other six people first,
right,
they would have said, huh, what?
Exactly, just like Mr. Farr did.
And they would have talked to Farr, and everything that came out, ultimately, would have come out. And Farr would have been fired. So I just don't comprehend what difference it makes in what order they interview the employees.
That's where I disagree. Because had everyone denied it, and had they known that everyone denied it, and the passwords were meaningless, then the investigation could have been done.
And gone home.
The investigation could have gone on properly, and they could have discovered from the very start that this was malware and not a problem. And had they asked Mr. Farr, why were you looking at these sites, instead of waving papers and saying you did something bad, but we're not going to tell you exactly what it was, he could have explained that it was not something bad. It was like looking at puppy dog sites or whatever. But everything flows from that.
Yeah, well, as I say, this is why the argument you're making seems to me to boil down to a claim to a labor arbitrator. The employer didn't have to believe that looking at hacking sites is the same thing as looking at puppy dog sites.
But they went further than that. The employer did. The employer said he was not just looking at hacking sites, that he was downloading hacking tools and raising his elevating his administrative position and compromising hospital security, and none of that.
This may be right or it may be wrong, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with sex.
But it's pretextual. They had their guy, they knew they had their guy, and they were going to get rid of him. And they replaced him with a woman who wouldn't do that sort of thing in the future. Anyway, moving on, since we seem to be at an impasse on this. With respect to defamation, the Alverno report that was given to the grievance committee carried defamatory information about Mr. Farr. It wrongly accused him of downloading hacking tools, of compromising the medical system, the medical reporting system, by opening it up to the world, basically. He did none of those things. The court wrongly decided that that was protected by absolute privilege, when in fact there is a clearly articulated privilege in this regard. The St. Francis maintains that it's absolute because he consented, and respectfully, we disagree with that interpretation. We think that that is gleaned from an old case that is not applicable here. The Indiana Supreme Court in Balls, the Balls case, Balls versus Verduzco, clearly said that you do not, that there is no, that it's a qualified privilege for intracompany communications. That was followed in subsequent cases. And so the correct standard is qualified immunity, and that is not. Mr. Farr has met the standard on qualified immunity to withstand a motion to dismiss. With respect to fair dealing. We're not asking that the court, this is absolutely mainstream Indiana law. All we're asking is that the benefit offered in the handbook be enforced. We're not asking that employment at will be a problem. We're not asking to involve any discharge for cause. All we're asking is that the benefit promised in the handbook, that he be treated fairly, be enforced. And that is well in keeping with Indiana law on enforcing benefits protected within handbooks, described within handbooks.
Thank you, counsel.
You're welcome.
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you. Hey, please the court. My name is John Ryan, and I represent the Appalachian St. Francis Hospital. I would agree with Ms. Runnels that this case has everything to do with the facts and the record, and I think that the earlier argument highlighted a lot of that. As I look at this case, the facts that they've relied upon to support discrimination, starting with the discrimination claim, is that Mr. Farr's supervisor was female, his co-workers, the six other respiratory therapists in the department were female, and then the hospital is owned by a female religious organization. And that's it. In fact, in his deposition...
Female religious organization? What is that?
A group of nuns, Your Honor. Catholic.
I think that's different from a female religious organization.
I could have described that a little bit better. But that's it. In his deposition, Mr. Farr admitted that in order to support gender discrimination, it was his own speculation that supported that and nothing beyond that. Of course, in the briefing and in both the lower court and here, Mr. Farr has focused on his the investigation as a sham, the grievance hearing as a conspiracy. I'd like to think that neither were the case, and I think the facts support that. With respect to the investigation, there's this focus on the password, but I think it's important to remember what exactly he was terminated for. He was terminated for inappropriately using...
his employment was terminated.
His employment...
He has not been terminated, to the best of my knowledge.
He has not. You're correct. His employment was terminated based upon inappropriately accessing and using the hospital's electronic communication system. His employment was not terminated for sharing his password. And even in his own deposition, I asked him about password sharing in the department. He testified that first some people did use share passwords and some people didn't. He testified that he was aware of the policy that invested the confidentiality of his ID and password with himself. He admitted that he did have a practice of going in and signing on and leaving his password up during the course of the day. But again, as I mentioned, this wasn't why he was terminated. And of course, as our brief pointed out, and you did this morning, Your Honor, he admitted to doing what it is that we terminated him for. The investigation itself, I think, was very fair. The record shows as much. It's logical that because the computer was logged in under his name, that they were going to start with him first. They have IT confiscate the computer and do an analysis, and it shows a series of access to the Internet, hacking sites, pornography sites, under his username. They analyzed other employees' passwords and did not find anything. I probably would have stopped there, but the department goes one step further and cross-references schedules against the computer use. And on the day that most of the computer use, the inappropriate computer use that had been found, was completed, it was done on a day that he was only scheduled in the department. So only he was in the department that day. They didn't stop there. They analyzed other computers in the department to see if there was any suspicious activity on any of the other computers and found nothing at all. Then they gave him a chance to grieve the matter. Mr. Farr would say that the grievance was a conspiracy, I think it's easy to nitpick a multi-page report after the fact and find inaccuracies, but I'm not so sure that they were significant. And again, I can't emphasize enough the fact that he admits to doing that which he was terminated for. If I look at what they're suggesting, I think that they're suggesting that Mr. Farr is suggesting that he didn't maliciously do what he did. And I don't know that is or is not the case, but that wasn't why he was terminated. He wasn't terminated for maliciously and inappropriately accessing the computer.
It's old usages die hard.
His employment terminated. My apologies.
Well, I didn't say he was fired.
He was fired.
Why the preference for this euphemism?
Okay. He was fired. He was fired not for maliciously and inappropriately accessing the computer, but rather just for inappropriately accessing the computer. I think in a nutshell, Mr. Farr has approached this case as a criminal one, where if St. Francis is not capable of demonstrating beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this, that he should somehow be let off. And yet, in this case, St. Francis is the defendant, not Mr. Farr. And it is Mr. Farr that carries the burden to demonstrate that sex played a role in his St. Francis's decision to terminate his employment. Unless there are any additional questions with respect to the gender discrimination claim, I'm going to move on to the defamation claim. And of course, as Ms. Runnels pointed out, this claim lies in the rebuttal report that was prepared by St. Francis's IT department in response to a report that was prepared by Mr. Farr's purported experts in this case in the grievance hearing. Standard of law, which was espoused in earnest, an Indiana Court of Appeals decision, 1985, is that statements made in a grievance meeting are insufficient to support a cause of action for defamation because the party initiating the grievance constructively consents to publication of a rebuttal by the other side, thereby establishing an absolute privilege for statements made in that rebuttal. In Mr. Farr's briefs, he cites to the Brockman case and suggests that the Ernest decision was wrong because Brockman actually held the opposite of what Ernest held. I've read that case a couple of times since they've made that statement, and I still don't exactly understand where they're coming from there. Ernest is good law. The Balls case that Ms. Runnels, Balls versus Verduzco, an Indiana Supreme Court case that Ms. Runnels refers to, is a case where an employee, at least the employee after the fact, made a claim for defamation based upon defamatory or lies stated in personnel evaluations. And again, to this claim, the critical, where it pivots is who is initiating the review. In our case, Mr. Farr initiated the review of his own conduct. In the Balls case, there was no review at all. It was simply a statement after or a claim after the fact that statements made in a personnel evaluation contain lies. I would also point out with respect to the defamation claim that at the lower court level, Mr. Farr's claim and reaction to the motion to dismiss that was filed by St. Francis focused on the fact that his grievance hearing wasn't quasi-judicial enough. And that was their response. The lower court did not buy that and ultimately cited to the law espoused in earnest in making a decision. Well, now in their appeal, I would contend that they've waived the argument that they're making now because they've dropped entirely the argument with regard to the grievance hearing not being quasi-judicial enough, and now state that Ernest was bad law because it relied on the Brockman decision and has since been clarified to close out the prospect that Ernest is still good law. And again, I would contend on behalf of St. Francis that Ernest is the operative law here, the operative decision, and that by initiating the grievance, he constructively consented to the hospital's response, and the hospital was afforded an absolute privilege with respect to its rebuttal. And then finally, the claim for a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. This much is true. No Indiana court has ever recognized this claim. And if you look at Mr. Farr's brief, he tries to distinguish all the cases that have actually said that this claim is not recognized, and suggesting that this is somehow different than the cases that have come before it. But I think, as the lower court aptly pointed out, Farr can't have it both ways here. Indiana is an at-will state, meaning that an employer can terminate an employee at any time for any reason. Terminate an employee. Judge, my apologies. And were the court to allow or enforce a handbook to suggest that they have to demonstrate that they do it fairly before they do it, the lower court stated that this would upend the right of an employer to terminate the employment of an employee at any time. And so our position with respect to the claim for covenant of good faith and fair dealing is that claim is not recognized under Indiana law, and we would ask this court to affirm the lower court decision on that claim, that it is not a recognized claim. In conclusion, I would submit that we ask this court, St. Francis asks this court, to affirm the lower court's decision to dismiss both of the state penitent law claims with regard to defamation, the covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim, and also affirm the summary judgment decision with respect to Mr. Farr's gender discrimination claim. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.